This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe.
Hi friends, welcome to Red Ice Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for being here today. RedIceCreations.com is the website you can reach us from around the world, wherever there is internet access. I hope you're doing well, wherever you are. We are coming to you from Scandinavia, and it's quickly going into autumn here. We're rotating towards winter. Leaves are turning and falling, and frost is not far away now. So in the looming darkness, it's always a good idea to try to enlighten yourself with ideas and knowledge that helps you to understand the minor and the major cycles at play in the natural world. And we're going to do that today with Marty Leeds. He has been writing songs and poetry for over 18 years, and he has an interest in everything from philosophy, esoterica, mathematics, and the sciences. He was born and raised in southern Wisconsin, and he has lived in Washington, Oregon, and Colorado. On his website, MartyLeeds33.com, you'll find books and many of the videos containing his work. Marty was first with us in April 2012, and today he returns to talk about mathemagics, gematria, language, and specifically the English alphabet. Marty has come up with a cipher based on the phalanges of the hand, breaking the English alphabet into two sections, just as we have two hands, and then managed to examine or break down words that corresponds to numbers, according to this cipher. His new book is called Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Marty. It's good to talk to you again. Thank you for coming on the program once more.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Excellent. Everything is good with you, I hope. You've have the new website up and running, MartyLeeds33.com. I think that wasn't up by the time we talked last time, but that's up. And of course, your second book is now out, called Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1. So I guess you're working on Volume 2 right now, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm basically, I think about 80, 90 pages into it. It's all outlined and stuff, so it's just a matter of kind of banging it out. But yeah, so, and as of right now, I was just going to do two volumes, but it's looking like three, so we'll see what happens when I get closer to the end of this next one. So
there's a lot of stuff to draw on here, a lot of material, a lot of well, just general wisdom, I would say, and observations about the natural world and everything. And I hold a copy of the book here before me, and I've gone through it today and the day before, and it's really good stuff. Now, as you might know, I like kind of new terms. I like when people come up with new words. And I think I saw it on your website. I read that you're a mathemagician, right?
Yeah. I like, I mean, really, when, you know, going through a lot of this material, it really kind of, it brought me to this position where it was just like I looked at the world in a magical way, and it really, the construction of our world was magical, and so I kind of, you know, put the two together in a way. So
really good. Now, in the beginning, by the way, of your new book, I want to kind of just address that first. You state that, you know, I'm not a Freemason, I don't have any religious affiliation or whatever. Was that a question you got after the first book you released?
No, I just wanted to make it clear to people that, you know, that I didn't have an agenda, you know, that this was just something that, you know, a journey that I went through, and that I wasn't really backed by any sort of religious institution or organization, you know, that I was just doing this kind of on my own as an autodidact, and that I didn't have to own up to any, you know, well, like I said, political institution, religious institution, anything like that. So I wanted to make it very clear to the readers that there was no agenda here. You know, this was just kind of me laying this info out in the way that I understood it.
Definitely. Well, there's a special aura, if I can put it that way, around Freemasonry. I guess many people get a response, which is immediately to back away from it and to run and hide almost, while others might be drawn to it, I guess. Why is it so special, do you think? I mean, as you run through this, you'll notice that a lot of these things that you talk about and traditions and the way of going about these observations that we're going to get closer into has connections in many regards to Freemasonry. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's a body of knowledge is what it is, you know. And so when people shirk at the idea of, like, well, anything like Freemason, it's like, oh, it's an evil institution, it's a satanic or evil organization or something like that. I don't see it as that. I see it as these people, or I mean, originally anyway, at the core, Freemasonry was about holding on to this ancient knowledge and being able to, you know, keep it alive in one way. Now, the Freemasonry of today, I don't know about it. You know, I can't speak on behalf of it because I'm not a Freemason. I do see that a lot of the, well, I mean, the conspiracy theory, this sort of thing seems to be tied into that. But I don't see Freemasonry as like as an evil organization in and of itself, you know. As far as like, you know, people shirking from the idea of Freemasonry, you know, I think, you know, you've had Dennis Fetchel on before, and I think he said it best, that anywhere that anything that's vilified, that's where you want to look. You know, that's where you want to look, because that's where the answer is. And I couldn't agree with that more. And so, you know, when we look at Freemasonry, we automatically, a lot of people just get this emotional response. But that's not necessarily the response you should have, because I know that even I'm not a Freemason and I don't have any plans to be a Freemason, but a lot of their symbols, a lot of their stories and things like that have actually helped me in pursuing this work. And so, you know, I kind of, you know, I can't say whether or not it's an evil institution or not. I don't see it that way, you know?
Sure. Sure. And they, well, I mean, it's an old organization, but there certainly are older cultures and traditions. And as some people have pointed out, there's a lot of links to Judaism between Freemasonry. There's, and if we go into Judaism, there's close ties to the Egyptian tradition. And from there, we find both Hermetic and alchemical traditions as well. What are some of the cultures and organizations that you said you would say this draws upon, the things you've collected in the book? Maybe all of these I mentioned, but are there others as well, Marty?
You know, what I was searching for was, you know, ultimately, you know, I call it this like germinal seed of truth born from the stars, which is basically just like, well, like the perennial philosophy in a way. It was, to me, I wanted to understand where all of these things came from, like all the religions, Freemasonry, alchemy, Hermeticism. I wanted to understand where these things came from and why they had so many ties to one another, as far as like when you look at like comparative mythologies and things like that, where you have, you know, a foundation that's very, very similar between everything from like Christianity, Islam, etc. You know, so I wanted to search for where all these things came from originally, you know? And so to me, like Freemasonry, alchemy, Hermeticism, Christianity, these are garments that cultures place over this fundamental base of knowledge. And I see that fundamental base of knowledge, or that body of work, to be fundamentally numerical. And that's what I see. So to me, I didn't want to go in and try to understand Christianity in all of its eccentricities, or sure, Islam, or anything, yeah, like that. I wanted to get to the core of why these things came about in the first place. And by looking at number, I think you can answer a lot of it. I mean, and I do that in the videos and now with the books. And so, I'm trying to make the case for that anyway.
Yeah. You wrote in the book too, that, well, numbers is considered to be a unifying method of communication, I guess we could call it, and since this book is about the English language primarily, we need to get into a little bit of, you know, the root of language, I guess, as well. Which one do you think came first, rather, the numbers or the language? Very difficult to know, of course. But is there any indication to you, if you look at some of these things, that one must have been driving the other? What do you think?
Well, I look at numbers basically as, you know, I kind of take it from the Greeks and the Egyptians, where it's like basically numbers are these cosmological principles, and they had like the Ennead, which is this base nine, essentially, nine principles or whatever, that they run the world, that, you know, laws of number. And so the geometry and the sound and the pattern, everything come from these basic cosmic principles, you know. So if we talk about a primordial language, like, we, you know, there's a lot of talk about like the Tower of Babel and what was this primordial language, etc. To me, the primordial language is it's this confluence, or this coalescence or whatever, of symbol, geometry, sound, you know, the number itself. It's like that was the primordial language. And so when anybody spoke this primordial language, you know, of course, this is a mythology, but, you know, to try to bring us back to the origins of this, when they spoke, it wasn't just a sound that came out of their mouth. It was, you know, it illuminated things inside you, like, oh, this, I said a word, and so this brings up geometry. This brings up the sound. What does the sound mean? This brings up, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, a fundamental language is not just me speaking words that are dead. You know, these words are alive, and they have, and as far as I'm concerned, they have a numerical equivalent to them that can point to the interconnectivity of all things. So this this understanding has been broken up in a way. And so we don't see language as any having to do with geometry at all. But the construction of our alphabet in and of itself, just the characters like A or B, are geometric forms. So it's really telling you that language, as far as we understand, is much deeper than just the words that are coming out of my mouth, going into your head, coinciding with your internal dictionary and then spitting something back out to me. There's a lot more going on here, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. If we continue talking about origins of language and all that, and as another thing you bring up briefly in the beginning, that this language is might be an epiphenomena, something that came after consciousness. And I've also heard the argumentations from the other side that language actually shaped our consciousness as well. It's only when we begin using words that we begin to think in words and we define the external world according to these words. I've also heard people, like, for instance, expressing a more profound understanding when they begin to really look at things and name things for what they are and the components of. I've talked about the example of an ant before, for example. And at first they might just think, okay, well, it's an ant. But then when they begin to analyze it with the proper names, I guess, that's been given to the components of that makes up the ant, they have it's like their perception of the ant completely changes and they understand that it's much more complex than what they did at first. But where do you stand on that? Do you think that language shaped consciousness or vice versa, Marty?
I think it's completely intertwined, and so it's constantly, I mean, just like we're co-creators of our world, the language that we use is constantly creating our world. And so I think it's a give and take. I think a lot of times we live in an either or society, a very dualistic polar society, and so we want to say it's one or it's the other. But I think all of these things are intertwined. And I think this actually speaks to the word or the word of God, which is akin to the logos. And the logos is this, well, it's an animating principle pervading all things. But more than that, it's also, it has all these definitions and different meanings. Like it means, ratio, symbol, all of these different things. So, when we talk about the word of God, I think all of this stuff is intertwined. And it's only the human beings that have separated and divided this stuff. And we actually see this in our scientific world today, that we tend to separate everything. And my opinion is all of this stuff is intertwined. And so if you talk about just consciousness shape language shape consciousness, I think they're completely intertwined. And only if we try to separate them, then we get a lesser understanding of what we're actually talking about.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think one doesn't develop on its own and then stand alone for a few tens of thousands of years and then something new comes along. It seems to be a fairly coherent, organic process where things just develop kind of side by side. So it's pretty interesting. Let's talk a little bit about gematria or gematria, what that is, and maybe you can define this term for our listeners and those who might not know, and of course how you've applied this to your work, Marty.
Well, the straightforward definition is gematria is the ancient art of assigning numbers to letters to reveal deeper meaning and significance to words. Now, this comes like straight out of Wikipedia, mind you, but this is like the most straightforward way to understand this. And so we see more often than not, we just see a word, we just see letters, and it doesn't, it's just a word, it's just a letter. But these actually are built off numerical foundation. Now, so many of other languages in history, we know for a fact, had this. We know Egyptian had it. We know Greek had it. We know Hebrew had it. I was like, okay, well, is there one for the English alphabet? Well, I mean, if all of these cultures had it before, well, to me, assuredly, there should be, And so that I kind of pursued that. And using all of these, Freemason symbols, ideas, and not just Freemasonry, anywhere I could look, psychology or history or Hermeticism or anything, philosophy, and used all of these tools to help me figure this out in a way. And so the cipher I have for the English alphabet, it's in this new book, it basically splits the alphabet in half. 13 letters and 13 letters. And I don't know if you want to go into this right now.
Yeah, sure. Let's do that, Marty. I think that's interesting. Yeah.
Okay. So basically what I did, and I have a video on this, it's called The English Alphabet. And you can look it up, martyleeds33.com. But basically I explain the alphabet. And what I did is I took the 26 letters of our alphabet, I split them in half, and then I put them on my hands. And so I'll go through this real quick. A is your thumb and Z is your other thumb on your hand. And of course your hands are symmetrical. And so you have 12 sections of your four fingers. So A becomes your thumb, and then you have B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M on your left hand. And then on your right hand, you have N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z. Now, splitting the alphabet between your hands, basically what I did then is I walked up to 6 days of creation and then rested on the Sabbath, which is the seventh day, and then I just walk back down. So A is 1, B is 2, C is 3, D is 4, E is 5, F is 6, and G is 7. And that's the Sabbath, and that's where I rested. And then I walk back down. So 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So that gives 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 for your A through M on your left hand of your alphabet. And because your left hand is symmetrical, or a mirror of your right hand, you can just place those numbers onto your right hand. So N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z becomes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now, this is a septenary system. And so what you can do with this is why we're resting on the seven or the 7 days of creation. This actually refers to the Freemasonic symbol of the square and the circle. You have a compass and then you have a square. And this is the ancient art of squaring the circle. When you do this, this is what the Great Pyramid of Giza does. You get the radius of the earth and the moon being 5,040 miles. And I explain this in depth in the video, but why this 7 becomes important is because 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6 times 7, that's the G where we rested, is 5,040. So the squaring the circle of that compass and square is telling you about the radius of the earth to the combined radius of the earth and moon. And so this is basically the cipher. So you split your alphabet in half, and you're basically just using this base 7, the septenary system. Now, why this is important is because the original Hebrew Bible was called the Septagon, and that means it's a 7. And I'm looking at my Holy Bible right now. It's a Masonic edition. I think it's from 1932. And there's only one thing on the cover. It doesn't even say Holy Bible. It has a G and a compass and a square in it. Mm. And it's basically telling you that in order to truly read this thing, you have to read it in more so than just your literal interpretation, your base level storyline. There's so much more in this, you know. And so basically that's kind of how I derived the cipher. So this is in the book and then in a couple of videos. So
yeah. Now it's really interesting. So now how did you, was this through looking at your hands that you divided the alphabet accordingly, or was this something you found elsewhere in reference works or other sources and decided, hey, that's a cool system, let's try that kind of thing?
It was the Greek Delphic Oracle was basically, and it was, you know thyself. It was two words that basically told me to do this, and that was it. And it was to know thyself. And so it was the idea that it was like, if I'm speaking the alphabet and it has a numerical foundation, this is the idea I had before I even come up with this. Well, then it's got to be attached or like come through me somehow, you know? And so the idea of like putting it on your hands is that you use your hands every day to do everything, make love, write, work, you know, whatever you do. And yet we hardly ever look at our hands. And so when I did this, you know, it was like, it just was like a perfect match, you know. And it was literally just the Greek Delphic Oracle saying to know yourself, look at yourself, understand yourself. I mean, I think even Lao Tzu, whatever his name is, said, he who knows the world is ignorant, but he who knows himself is enlightened. You know, I'm paraphrasing that, but basically that was the philosophy that I had, you know, and then it just ended up working. So I just kind of went with it.
Well, if you look at it from the alchemical point of view of Adam and Kadmon and the fact that man and woman might represent the, the perfected being, the one who is a reflection of the universe, basically, then we should, of course, have these ratios and the whole pattern incorporated into the human body. So we should be able to look at ourselves, basically, and be able to therefrom derive a lot of wisdom, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we are made in the image of God. So somehow this fundamental pattern of the human being is an expression, the most elegant expression that the universe has ever done, because literally we're the last thing that the universe decided to do. So let me say this. We have 14 sections on your hand, right? You have two on your thumb and then three on each hand. So that gives the total sections of your two hands to be 28, right? Holy Bible. H is 6, O is 2, L is 2, Y is 2, B is 2, I is 5, B is 2, L is 2, and E is 5. This comes together to give you 28. So what is the Holy Bible? you. You're the Holy Bible, accordingly, using the math. And so I found that very, very interesting.
There's a lot of interesting words here that you've dug up. Now, I want to go back to that again, because there's a couple of features I want to talk about here. If we divide it then, as you did, from A to Z in half first, and then at seven, as you said, the number seven, we count up from A, B, C, D, E, F, G is where number seven is. And then if we've done the division on the two hands, as you did, we check the next 13 sections of that, the letters, we go from N up to T. That's seven. So we have the G and the T at the seventh instances when we made the division. So G, obviously, as you explained, is featured prominently within the Masonic symbol. There's certainly other things where G shows up quite a bit as well. And then the T, I always think about the Tau cross. So
absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about G and T and the significance of those two letters and how that kind of these symbols show up in a lot of other places as well, Marty.
Yeah, well, let's look at the G first, right? Basically what the G is in its most simple form, right, is basically, let's say you have a compass. You pierce a page, and then you have the radius that the compass makes. Well, if you swing that compass around almost all the way, you know, let's say 270 degrees, 200, 300 degrees or whatever, and then you connect the radius, well, that gives you the letter G. You see what I'm saying? It's kind of imagery, but, you know, so it's like basically you have the radius, you draw the radius out, and then you swing it around, and this gives you the G. So that right there, the G itself is kind of telling you about, well, I mean, geometry, really, you know, and mathematics. So, and then you look at the T. The T is always a symbol for man. And, you know, you can see this in the Vitruvian Man, of course. But all you have to do is put your feet together and put your arms out, and you have a T, you know. This is in the Egyptian Ankh as well, you know. And what's more interesting is that, and I would actually direct you to Scott Onstott. He has and his blog. He's got this whole blog on the Tau cross, and it's fantastic. But basically, the mathematical idea of the Tau, which is taken from the Greeks, is this really simple way to understand sine and cosine. And without making, and it's basically, tau is pi twice, is essentially what it is. It's 6.28.
I was going to ask you about that because the symbol looks identical.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I was just going to say. So, and not only that, is that if you're talking about 2 pi, right, well, what are you essentially talking about? You're talking about two circles, right? Well, those two circles have the, in order to get pi, you need the line that goes down to find the diameter. So really, kind of what are you looking at? Are those two closed eyes you're looking at, you know? Or let's bring those two circles together. Is that the Vesca Pisces? You know what I mean? So it really starts to, you know, sends you down this world, into this world of geometry and mathematics and proportion by the simple symbol, you know? And there's another thing I could go into right here, but it would probably be better with visuals. And it's something I'm going to look into. I'm working on in the second book, but it's very interesting. So, I mean, literally this symbol for T is talking about you. It's talking about the man. And then if you actually look at just the cross itself, you know, I mean, how many buildings are built? I mean, how many cathedrals or, you know, temples are built in this cross shape, you know? Well, that really resonates with that symbol for a T. And then really, like, how simple is that in one way? You're just putting two lines together, yet those two lines, that simple geometry, can tell you about a whole world of understanding the world around you, you know?
Indeed. Now, you have a lot of these sketches, the drawings, the images, and stuff like that in the book, of course. And then I reference people right now to the videos you've made, and I'm going to link a few of these up as well, because it breaks a lot of this down, and also easy, you can get easy visual representation of the division of the alphabet, the cipher that Marty talked about. If we go back to the English alphabet again, it's obviously based on the Latin alphabet to begin with, or the Latin letters rather. And I've always been curious where, you know, who came up with this and why. And what, and there seems to be an interesting division, as the English language seems to be an upgrade, if you will, from what the Vatican, the Catholic Church, created first with the Latin alphabet. How much do you know about the Latin letters, Marty?
Well, I mean, I was more focused on, well, I mean, this kind of sounds self-absorbed, but myself, you know, like what, you know, I speak the English alphabet, you know, so what can I do with this? You know, that's the alphabet that I know. I mean, now we know that it was taken from Latin, you know, and so I don't know how this was transferred. You know, we then we get into like, where do languages come in the first place? And right. I have no idea. I wish I had a better answer, but I have to be honest. I do not know. The only thing I can say is my own personal relationship with this material. You know, so when we say where do languages come from, or what happened between, you know, Hebrew to Latin, or Latin to, you know, et cetera. The only thing I could point to is like these alchemical illustrations. You know, one of the things that this cipher does, at least as far as I'm concerned, is gives the Tetragrammaton, which is this holy name of God. Now, if you look at any alchemical illustration by Daniel Milius, you know, Anastasius Kircher, any of these guys, you know, the Tetragrammaton is up in the clouds, and it's got, you know, the rays of the light of light shining from it. And it's like this representation of God. And so to me, it's like, you know, this may seem like a cop out, but where do languages come from? I have to say, God. This is my own personal experience with it. And this is what the people of the past, as far as I know, you know, studying these illustrations, paintings, etc., that's what it kind of tells me. Now, if a scientist was having a conversation with a scientist right now, it'd be like, "Oh, it's a cop out." But I don't think so. You know,
do you think it was given to man by God, or was it thought out by very wise human beings who were sitting around philosophizing about this? I would just want your personal take on that, obviously, because I understand you can't know that. So,
yeah, I honestly don't have an answer for you. You know, yeah. It's just like, I can't see how mankind could have constructed this, right? I don't, especially dealing with it for so much and how much this actually, decodes in one way. But at the same time, I can't see how mankind built the Great Pyramid of Giza, yet I believe that they did. So I'm kind of at a loss as to how this could have been constructed, who did it, how it evolved. I will say this, though, and we started the conversation with this. To me, it really harkens to the idea that our reality is much, much more magical than we think. Much more magical than we think. This interplay of numbers is the way that the grand architect, the great geometer, is constructing the universe and is at play with these numbers. That's my belief and my contention. So.
Yeah, yeah. And that's been, in my view, taken away as well, Marty. It's being taken away with our so-called education, and is not something you learn right away. This is very esoteric stuff that people who only dare to ask these kind of questions, maybe even much later in their life, actually begin to discover. So it's something that's been pushed to the back. Although, as you pointed out in your book as well, we have people like Newton and all these guys who are considered to be behind the scientific field. They were into alchemy. They were into esoteric and occult stuff. And that is actually at the root in many regards of the scientific field. Yet now what we have today, the fruits of that, has been incredibly cleaned out. It's very clinical, and it's basically just if even the bone fragments left.
Yeah, and it's really upsetting. It's one of the things that I came to after, you know, several years. I mean, you know, leaving school, I didn't graduate college or anything. I didn't, you know, I only spent like a year and a half at the university level or whatever. But when I stopped my schooling, I realized very quickly that it was going to take, you know, I had to unlearn everything I learned. I spent more time unlearning the things that I had learned that I was taught than I actually was learning, you know. And so, and this is really the thing that I want to say, or a message that I want to, you know, purvey to people, is that I'm a guy of average intelligence, you know, and this is not forced humility here. This is not me being humble. This is me being honest. You know, this stuff, what I'm showing is simple. It's simple. Absolutely. If I can understand it, anyone can. And so this is the thing that's the most important. So our school systems are teaching the wrong stuff. They really are. And they have no intention of teaching us the right things. And we're not looking for education. We're looking to be enlightened. And you can strip all the esoteric or spiritual baggage from that and actually look at when you teach somebody the golden ratio and then they go out into the woods, you can see it everywhere. You know, you can see it on the human body, you know, you can recognize it. And so therefore, when you're in the middle of the woods or whatever, or you're in a group of people, it's not this chaotic thing. You can actually see order, pattern, structure everywhere.
Yeah.
And what does that structure lead us to? An intelligence in nature. Absolutely. You know, and so what is that intelligence in nature? This matrix of intelligence, this divine force? Well, people called a god. And as somebody who has not been a spiritual person, like I said, I'm not a Freemason. I'm not part of a religious organization. This was going through this was a spiritual experience. And that's what I've been focusing on. So,
yeah. And this is what's so interesting about this. We're trying to measure this in different ways, or some people are, and we're trying to set ourselves outside of it. The whole scientific field is a prime example of this as well. It's trying to measure things by taking it out of its environment and then kind of strip it down or see how it functions or dissect it or whatever they do. But the fact is, if we're inside of this system, if we're part of it, we cannot measure it for what it is. And I think you brought this out in the beginning of the book as well. Kurt Gödel, the Austrian-American logician, right? He said that the incompleteness theorem, he called it. Do you recall that, Marty?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Basically, what Kurt Gödel was a mathematician. I think he was 19 when he put out the two papers, and he was actually awarded the Einstein Award for Mathematics. And actually, he helped Einstein actually helped him get his visa for America. This guy was 19, and basically, what the incompleteness theorem says is that you can't have if you're standing inside a circle, you automatically have to be standing outside a larger circle in order to do the measuring in that circle. I hope I explained that well enough.
Yeah.
But basically, we can't measure anything that's outside of ourselves. You know what I mean? So this idea of science trying to take the human perspective out of science, I think is just absolutely wrong, because you can't refute the scientist performing the experiment. And, you know, you can't do that. And so what does that mean for the scientific experiment in and of itself? What does that mean for us? And there is this kind of cycle of us. Well, I mean, we know this kind of from the observer effect in quantum physics, you know, that we're kind of intimately linked to everything around us. And now what's so important about this? It, to me, is that you don't need to understand physics, mathematics, any of this stuff to really see this in nature. I am connected to the ground, and you're connected to that ground. And we are inside this electromagnetic sphere together. That the air, we share the air. We share the Earth shares the space with the planets, with the galaxy. There is an interconnectivity and a oneness. And you can see this plain as day. You don't need to know math. You don't need to know science. You don't, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so this is why, to me, philosophy is so important, because philosophy can actually help you understand what we're looking at in science, you know, and back it up, you know. And this is, I say the same thing about fractals, you know. You don't need to know science or math at all to understand fractals. All you have to do is go out in your yard and look at a leaf. That leaf looks like the veins. The veins of the leaf look like the roots in the ground, look like the branches of that tree, you know. And then how many things can you do this with? Seed falls from the ground of a tree or whatever. The entire tree is within that seed. That's a fact, you know? And so what does that say about the nature of our reality? That it is fractal. And so I think to take ourselves out of the fact that we can actually see this is just, I will say it, irresponsible of science.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that. And it's, I think you have to approach the subject of philosophy if you're going to try to get closer to finding truth about where we are, what we're doing, and what this is all about. I think people try with the scientific method and all these different ways of trying to, determine what reality is, what really happened, both historically and everything else. But the fact is, as you say, when we are part of this reality, we're part of the experiment, of the measurement of everything. We need to go into these other places to begin to understand how reality is comprised, what it is, and ultimately then, if we consider that to be the truth, to get closer to the answer, you know, what the truth basically is about anything. And hence philosophy is where it's at, for me anyway. We can sit and measure things all day or look at documents or whatnot, but the fact is the philosophy and the philosophers, that's where the real magic happens, Marty, if you ask me.
Yeah, if I may say this, this really speaks to what's going on at the Large Hadron Collider. I was listening to this TED Talks. I was watching this TED Talks with Brian Cox, who's like he's the spokesperson for the LHC. He's like the young rock star physicist, and he's up on the stage, and he's got an audience of TED Talks people, which those are intelligent people, right? And so he's got on the screen, he's got the mass equation for the Higgs boson, right? And it's this long, arduous, ugly ass equation, and he's pointing to this, and he's saying, well, this equation will explain everything. It'll say, you know, why DNA has the structure it does, why the grass is green, and why, you know, the sky is blue, you know, why farts stink, you know, and then and then he says, but something's missing. And of course, the thing that's missing is the Higgs boson. And he says, can anybody tell me what it is? And the audience laughs. And he starts laughing. And then I recognize right away, is that why? Why are they all laughing? Because no one has any idea. This thing doesn't make any sense to anybody. Even if they found the Higgs boson, would that mean anything to you? No, it wouldn't. Yeah. You know? And so what does this say? I take the philosopher, speaking of philosophy, the philosopher's credo. I think it's George Keats. Truth is beauty, and beauty is truth. Look at that equation. Is that beautiful? No, it's not. So is that truth? No, it's not. Everybody, you know, every mystic, magi, philosopher of the past would say, I think, would say the same thing. And so this is the path that I'm trying to take. Now look at a flower. That's the truth. Why? Because it's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. Now, let's talk a little bit about how this works, or rather why it works. These so-called coincidences between observable reality, the words we've given them, and then their numerological, you know, representations or whatever you want to call it. It's pretty amazing when you get into it. As I sift through the findings in your book, Marty, you realize that there's something larger at work here. It can't be coincidence. It's something else. And one begins to wonder about the structure of, again, the system that we're part of and how that works. Some people have tried to explain it as being, I don't know, holographic, or as you said before, Marty, it's basically God's creation, the source creation, and therefore whatever we observe, whatever we give names to, whatever we try to figure out as a part of this equation, it is going to reflect this basic underlying truth of the coincidences between you know, seemingly different objects or words, even, or the words we've given to these objects. It's pretty amazing. How do you explain it? How does it work?
Magically. let me give you a few examples about something that happens every single day that you would think is not connected to the very words we speak or mathematics. All right, let's look at the sun. The sun, when it rises and sets, it rises or sets on the horizon. Of course, this is Horus rising, or the zone of Horus, right? Well, horizon is H is 6, O is 2, R is 5, I is 5, Z is 1, O is 2, and N is 1. This comes together to give you 22. 22 divided by the seven letters of horizon, or Horus rising, is pi. 3.142. Now, what's more important is that when the sun rises and sets on the horizon actually creates the diameter to find the circumference of the sun. So the very words we speak are, you know, intrinsically and intimately connected to that large, you know, body in the sky. Now, what happens when Horus rises? It's the morning. M is 1, O is 2, R is 5, N is 1, I is 5, N is 1, and G is 7. This comes together to give you 22. 22 divided by 7 is pi. Hmm. So there's, you know, this is the two very words that we speak, that we say to speak about this event that happens every single day. Yeah. Now, when you say morning, do you ever think about pi? No. Who does? Yet that's exactly what it's pointing to. And now geometrically, like literally, when that sun gets that halfway, you can derive pi that way. And so this is, you know, this is just two examples of you know, of ways that kind of shows the interconnectivity of everything. The sun in our sky, the very words we speak, the geometry and mathematics that we work with.
Yeah.
This to me is, I have no other word for it, but magical.
Yeah, indeed.
And I have no way to explain how this works. Now, maybe I'm just not that intelligent, and somebody 20 years from now will be able to, you know, put all the pieces in place and stuff. But as of right now, what it says to me is that the world that we've inherited is not this materialistic, accidental world of just, you know, and then we have no place in it. Quite the contrary.
Yeah.
We're front and center to the whole thing, and that everything that we say, every move that we make, every, you know, every action that we take speaks of the divine. And I find it really interesting that when we talk about a primordial language, in the Divine Comedy, Dante, he says that Adam addressed God as I rather than L. Now, this is very interesting because it's basically saying, recognizing that you are God, you know, and that everything you do is a divine, sacred thing, every action. And so then if you understand that, you're going to look at your actions in a whole different way. You know what I'm saying? You know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So what's the mess that we're in right now? You know, I mean, I think we're in a spiritual crisis because we're not recognizing the divinity of ourselves, the sacredness of ourselves and the sacredness of this earth that we live on. And what's more important is what I said before is about, you know, I'm not that intelligent. And yet I can understand this stuff. And what does this really point to? The fact that you can square the circle and get the radius of the earth and moon very simply through the numbers 1 through 7. It means we need to relearn this stuff and rethink this thing through, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The whole mathematical field has always been a weird kind of subject matter to me. I never liked it in school. I never understood it. And then later on, when I got into geometry and understanding ratios and things, it opened up in a different way. And it got more, if I worked it the way I wanted to, it made more sense. And it wasn't difficult as it was before. So that's another point in all of this as well. I think we go about it the completely wrong way in school when we begin to not talk about the fact that the numbers themselves, first of all, are magical representations, and the fact that, I mean, I don't know if this would go into a kid that's 6 or 7 years old, but I think so, actually. If we showed some of the incredible relations between it, I think that would captivate young children. What do you think, Marty?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I can only imagine if somebody taught me this stuff when I was younger, you know, but I wasn't taught this. You know, why every interview that I've done thus far basically is somebody, you know, the interviewer has said, I don't like math. You know, I was always taught math. I was never good at school. I always shied away from it. And that's interesting.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting that all of us don't like math? I'm not a mathematician. I think I said that last time when I was in the year, but I don't really feel like I am. But I could understand this as if it was a language. I'm not a linguist either, but I speak the English alphabet.
You're a mathematician, Marty.
Exactly right. Squaring the circle is something you could teach a fourth grader, a third grader could understand this. And so it would thrust them into this world of dissymmetry and proportion and geometry and ratio and numbers and all of these things. But what are we taught? Jane has 14 apples and she gives 2/3 to Bob, you know, and then what is that? It doesn't say anything, you know, and of course we don't like math because we're taught math that way. No one ever taught math as in like, oh, here's a pentagram. Five-sided star, that one, you know, part of that star has a ratio of 0.618 and the other part is one. So every time that you subconsciously drew a star when you were younger, you were talking about phi, Fibonacci sequence, phi, you know? Mm. And so how easy would it be to teach young Jimmy about that? But we don't. Why? You know, I think it's because it's been suppressed and it's been kept from us.
Yeah, I think so.
And so that's what's compelled me to write the books. As a mediocre, half intelligent person, it was like, oh, I can understand this stuff. I feel obligated. I feel like a responsibility to try to share this in any way I can. And maybe I'm not the best spokesperson for it or whatever. But, you know, if I can get some information out, then, well, you know, it's a noble deed, I think.
Indeed. You know? I mean, I think you do it very well, Marty. And I think definitely that material you've put together and composed, it definitely could be used for learning material. Your material together with some of the other stuff out there, but like Michael Schneider and so forth. I mean, I think that should be 101, at least for parents who want to give their kids something outside of school so they can understand a different relationship or develop a different relationship to the numbers when they're trying to learn math and stuff, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, I learned more from Michael S. Schneider's book than I learned from any math class I ever had, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it says it right there, you know. And then what's so wonderful about his book, and there's a lot of other books out there, but like John Michelle and Robin, Richard Heath, these guys.
Sure.
You know, what it does is it links you to your history, you know. Squaring the circle, that's what the Great Pyramid of Giza does. You know, so if you learn squaring the circle, then automatically if you're teaching somebody that, you can be like, well, okay, now let's go to Egypt. And then you're going to start, you know, getting people to think. And, you know, our school system, the curriculum, doesn't want us to be free thinking individuals. They don't teach. They teach us what to think and not how to think.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to do is like, you know, I mean, if anything, you know, I want to teach people to fish and then go fish yourself. You certainly don't need me, you know, and you don't even need to give me any money. You know, I mean, my videos are free. You don't have to buy my book. You can just go watch the videos. They're commercial free, you know. So, and this is very important to me anyway.
Absolutely. It's really good stuff. Now, in a few minutes here, we're going to take a little break. We have a little bit of time left, but I wanted to go back to the idea. You briefly were into it, talking about ourselves as the experiencer or the fact that we're the central node, if you will, in all of this. And the other interesting part here in the book that I haven't thought about before, the six-pointed star, the axis, and the fact that we're like the seventh point in the center. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I find that really interesting.
Yeah. When you have like the 6 days of creation and then God resting on the seventh, well, this is there, you know, in one way, of course, every story in the Bible, I think, has many layers to it. And I think Manly P. Hall even said that there's seven layers per story, you know. So when you look at the 6 days of creation and resting on the seventh, well, this is actually the XYZ coordinates of any sort of, you know, three dimensional mathematics, right? So you have XYZ, the three directions with their opposites being six. And then the central point is that origin point or that axis point, the axis of the six dimensions. Axis is just an anagram really for a six. And then of course the being the alpha or yourself resting on that central axis point. Now this is actually what we see when we walk down the street and we live our everyday lives. You know, there's forward and reverse and left and right and up and down. And so, but with the story of the 7 days of creation, you know, the Holy Bible is actually telling you about geometry, which I find extremely interesting. You know, this is, can I say something I just came up with days ago,
Go
if you
ahead.
Don't mind?
Yeah, of course.
Talking about geometry. When you juggle, one point you have to, it takes three balls to juggle, right? You can have, you have one ball represents, this is basically the fundamental geometry of creation. One ball is a point and it can be infinitely large or infinitely small. Two balls, which you can't juggle yet, is just two balls in a line and really no geometry, no space. But it's only when you get three balls that you actually can juggle. And that's actually the three points to create the first, well, you'd say triangle or tetrahedron or whatever, if you look at it in three dimensions, of space. So this threefold becoming one is very important. And you actually see this in the art of juggling. So now you have 14 sections of your hand, right?
Yep.
Let's assign the ball 14. Okay. So now we have one ball that equals 14, representative of the 14 sections of your hand. The other ball equals 14. And now we're going to put one more in there, giving us 3/14 or pi, 3/14. Get that? Okay, now that's kind of sketchy, right? Now, let's look at 14 and look at this axis or this 6, right? S is 6, I is 5, X is 3. 6 plus 5 plus 3 equals 14. So therefore, if you're assigning the ball juggling 14, you have 3/14, well, that 6 equals 14. So now what do you have? You have 666. This is the art of juggling. Now, this we know that the Egyptians did this. We have sketches on the walls that they did this. So when you learn to juggle or whatever, how often do you think about geometry? How often do you think about 666? How often do you think about pi? But really, by doing this magical art, you know, that's what it's pointing to. And I find that just absolutely fascinating, you know.
Interesting. I never thought about that before. That brings back some of these older traditions we can see, you know, in you have circuses, you have some of the depictions in the tarot cards with the fools and the court jester and all this. I don't know, I always find it kind of weird, but it's interesting that there might be like a deeper message behind. Well, I've heard that about even ritual dances and stuff like that from more ancient cultures, that there's like these are teachings that actually incorporate certain you know, lessons, basically life lessons that are passed down through generations. But, you know, within that, there's actually wisdom that can be extracted. And maybe we don't understand it from day one as we watch or witness. And I wonder how much of that goes on in our culture, things that we just repeat, basically, daily rituals. But the fact is they actually hold something, you know, way more profound and older. What do you think, Marty?
Absolutely. Dance. What do you do when you dance? You shuffle your feet, you move it around, right? You swing your arms, you're constantly in motion, right? So let's take that idea and let's actually place it onto the word dance, right? D is 4, A is 1, N is 1, C is 3, and E is 5. Did I say that right? D is 1, or D is 4, A is 1, N is 1, C is 3, and E is 5. Shuffle those letters around, and that's an anagram for pi, or 3.1415. So what is dance telling you to do? I mean, the actual acting of dance is telling you to shuffle things around, you know? And so now let's take this idea and let's actually put it on the word itself. You know, and so, and that, and then what do you do? What do you get? You can easily get pie that way. You have to look for it. You have to be creative. You have to think in a magical term. You have to change your precept or your perception, but that's there. And so how many words are like this? How many things are like this? So any ritual or anything like that, whenever you see whatever it is, movements of bodies, whatever, you know, whatever you undergo in a ritual, there's always a deeper meaning in there. Everything on the planet has a deeper meaning, in my opinion. You know, nothing is arbitrary. And so whatever you look at, whenever you look at any of these older ideas, rituals, mythologies, things like that, you have to understand that there's definitely layer upon layer there, and that they don't do this thing. They don't do these things arbitrarily. They do them for a reason.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a different relationship that we can develop to the things that we experience in our daily lives. And even people who are into, you know, the conspiracy or whatever, watching all these things on the news every day, and the fact to still try to apply a magical type of thinking onto this. It doesn't mean that it's not serious or not detrimental, but there is always another layer to this of why certain things happen in the world. And again, this dance that you talked about, I can't help to go back to the one of the passages here that you have about the unity of opposites, because that's how I view everything, basically. It's kind of one of the unwritten mottos for Red Eyes, coincidentia oppositorum, right? The unity of opposites. We have this dual nature to everything. You, in every act, you can find something good or something bad, but together these they're opposites, but they stem from the same thing, and together they dance. And through their action of doing this, you get the creative force coming out of it. How do you view this, Marty?
Whenever I see unity of opposites, I always want to combine them and see neither as left or right or black or white as good as or good or bad. I want to combine those two. And so you had this guy, Paul Levy, on, and he was talking about, he was in Portland, he was giving some kind of speech, and he was at this like yoga studio, and he was talking about the darkness, and they ended up kicking him out because they were like, no, we don't want to talk about the darkness. And to me, this is so silly, because, you know, I think you even said it in the interview that you need the darkness and the light combined. Yeah, yeah. Whenever you see a shadow, that just means that there is light. And so when, you know, we have this idea, a lot of spiritualities have this idea, and we've seen this throughout history, that matter is bad, that matter is evil, and it's all about spirit. And so they've always wanted to go one way or the other. But we experience this, you know, this existence through matter. So matter can't be bad. You know, this experience, I don't think is a negative experience or a bad thing, you know. And so, you know, I look at, you know, you hear a lot of like these gurus or whatever, people saying that, you know, you should abstain from sex, or you should abstain from alcohol or whatever, or, you know what I mean? It's like, to me, it's all about the balance between the good and evil. You know, it's like saying, you know, I mean, I've gotten, you know, pun intended, pie-eyed drunk before and had a blast, had a wonderful time. Now, if I did that every day of my life, of course, I'm going to be completely unbalanced. I'm basically, you know, the scales of the Libra scales, my matter would be too heavy, and then I wouldn't have enough spirit. So whenever somebody, or look at sex, for instance, sex is awesome. Enjoy it personally. I like it on Facebook. You know what I mean? So to say that that is bad and you should abstain from that, I think is just a terrible message. And I think it's when we look at the unity of opposites, the key word there is unity, is to combine those two. The yin swirls with the yang, and that is true. You know, I mean, in order for us to continue on as a species, the man and female have to come together. You know, I mean, I think that that's a fact. Yeah. It is a fact. Yeah. You know, so and so this is a way to perceive the opposites as good. You know what I mean? As one, as a unified being, and that's the philosophy that I take.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. I think that's, well, the fact is also, Marty, that it's going to be subjective what is considered to be so-called negative. If it's a phobia, I mean, you and me can sit here and talk about frogs or socks, and someone has a phobia and then accuses us of being, you know, negative or spreading, you know, fear-mongering or something like that, right? So it's all about their own reflection of what you have inside, what you consider to be so-called dark or negative. It's going to be a reflection of something that you lack within yourself. So these things will be different for everybody. And what you said about, you know, being abstaining from certain things and everything else, I always go back to the Buddha, you know, the Buddhist lesson, when he kind of went through all the trials or difficulties, or he tried to, you know, break the suffering and understand things. But he, as far as I understood that, he came out the other end and basically had a realization of balance. Like it, There's not a problem if you do certain things. You can do whatever you want, just as long as you have a good approach to it and a good balance. But it's like he had to live through all these difficulties and extremes, if you will, to be able to come to that that perception or that understanding. So again, that's a level that's going to be different for anybody. I think the trick is to just take a step back and instead of maybe observing oneself, what do I need in this situation to move along or to feel more whole or what have you, instead we end up looking at everyone else and everything else that goes on in the world and try to blame that for what's wrong and try to, you know, decrease or increase something that we see in the world because we individually can't handle it, basically.
Yeah. This, you know, this idea of balancing the good and evil, the left, the right, you know, I mean, it to me is so important. And I think you see it all throughout nature. And I think this is, it says, who is it? I forget who said this, but he who holds fast to the golden mean and lives contently in between the little and the great feels not the wants that pinch the poor or plagues the haunt the rich man's door. The golden mean is a balancing point. And this is this 1.618 that you see everywhere. It's in the human body and every single plant. It's everywhere. So mean is a balancing point. It's all of nature balances on this. And so it's literally a flower when you look at it and how it grows, and it grows into this Fibonacci sequence, this sequence of phi. It's saying, it's telling you something. It's saying stay balanced. Now, what's even more interesting is that we see this 1.618 in the pentagram, in the star, you know, in this five-pointed star. The five is the balancing point between 0 and 10. It's the balancing point between 1 and 9, 2 and 8, et cetera. And so by the very numbers itself, it's telling you to stay balanced. You know what I mean? Where the number is and geometrically what it shows you. And this is a lesson of nature, and it's all around us. And so it's telling you what to do. Stay balanced. You live in this dimension. You were tempted into temus, I think, means time. It's Latin for time. So you were tempted into this world of time. And in the world of dimension of time is left and right. It's opposites. It's all around you. And so what do you have to do? Center the chi, you know, be a balanced person. I think this is, you know, how many people have taught this before, right?
Yeah, I know. Well, this is great stuff, Marty. We're going to continue talking more about this in the second hour when we return with more. There's obviously many things I want to discuss with you first here. We want to give out all the details about your work, about where to find you, about some of the things you've done and so forth. First of all, you were with us. It wasn't quite a year ago. It was a little bit less than that. I think we talked about your first book, Pi, the great work, kind of a introduction and a rundown, I guess, of the whole concept of Pi. And this is obviously something you've taken with you. It's kind of all in the background there all the time, it seems. And now your new book is called Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1. And as you said, Marty, you continue working on this and more is to come. Do you have any idea about outline of how many things you want to cover and touch upon, or are you going just where the flow is right now?
Just kind of going with the flow right now. I'm trying to finish up the second volume here, which I'm hoping it'll be out late this year, but it's probably early next, you know, if we make it. And so that's, you know, that's kind of my focus right now. It's just trying to get that done. And because I'm covering a lot more in depth, the first book, this volume one, was kind of a foundation of this material and kind of trying to tell the story about, well, the divinity of the self. And then the second volume, I'm really going to delve into a lot of different concepts. I'm looking at the Detractus and the Ennead and just a bunch of different things like that. And as of right now, it looks like I'm going to be doing a volume three. And that volume three, I want to get into, you know, the Tarot deck. I'd like to do that. The symbolism of the bee, things like that. So,
oh, cool. Now, you have a bunch of videos as well up on YouTube on your channel, and they're available through your website, MartyLeeds33.com. MartyLeeds33, the number is 33.com. That's the website where you can go to find out more, get copies of the book. They're available on Amazon and CreateSpace. There's links there on the website. Do you have any clue how many videos you have? I mean, you have a, sorry the terminology here, shitloads of different topics that you cover, Marty. So do you know how many you have so far?
No, I think maybe like 15 or 20 or something like that. I'm prepping a few more as well. I'm actually, a few ones I'm looking into right now is the Egyptian Mat, the 42 principles of the Egyptian Mat, which I'm covering in the second book. And then I have like two or three more. I'm actually going to use the cipher on everyday people's names, and show how this can actually, you can actually use this in your own life. And I was actually thinking about doing your name as well, which is interesting. So
cool. Yeah. I'd be interested in finding out that, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, all right.
So yeah, I think like 15 or 20 videos, and I'll be posting more as the time comes, and they're commercial free. You don't even have to sit through a commercial to watch them. I don't make any money on them. So it's, you know, it's all for the benefit of whoever wants to watch them. You know?
That's great. Thank you for that, Marty. Now, is there anything else you want to mention about the website, about what you could find on there, or any new feature or anything like that?
No, it just kind of points you to where, you know, where you can get my work and where the videos are and stuff like that. I will say I'm on a site, it's called schooloftheholiescience.org, and it's with Santos Bonacci, and a guy named Johan Oldenkamp. And you should really have him on because his work is very great. I think he's actually running for president of the Netherlands right now, the Green Party. But he does videos as well, and has some online PDFs that are really great. So you can get, that's kind of a central site to, you know, point us to Santos and I and all these other guys. So there's that. But yeah, MartyLees33.com is just sample chapters of the book, videos, some music, and some events that I'm doing. So,
all right, good stuff. I recognize the name Johan Oldenkamp, by the way. I think I've heard of that before. But the website was schooloftheholyscience.org.com. What was it?
.org.
Yeah. Okay, really good. We're going to have this link up there as well. Do check it out if you want to find out more. All right, Marty, stay with us. We're going to return with more in the second hour when we'll be back in a little bit. We'll be right back. second hour. Coming up, we're going to continue our very interesting discussion with Marty Leeds about everything from the scientific field to how knowledge is applied, perception, the potential of mankind, and people's convictions about their own beliefs. We break down the skull and bones and talk about mirrors, mirroring, polarization, and opposition. Marty shares more interesting discoveries from his new book, and we end talking about games, dances, rituals, and traditions that have been passed down through the generations that hold very interesting symbolic values. And if we could decode them or understand them, we'd realize that a greater significant lesson about the human experience and the natural world around us could be learned from these games. On redicemembers.com, you'll find much more of what we do. If you're enjoying our free archives and want to hear more, acquire a membership and get full access to our programs in their entirety going back to our start. You'll have at your fingertips a vast archive on all kinds of topics that I'm sure you will enjoy and both learn greatly from and maybe be challenged in some of your beliefs as well. Red Ice Radio has some great guests coming up with, for example, Katie Diolos and Andrea Hernandez on RFID technology and tracking of students in American schools. We have also Mark Gaffney, John Coleman, and then Scott Onstott, Dan Tatman, and Kevin McMahon for a round table on geometry, architecture, and numerology. Don't miss Rick Simpson, also Kent Bain and Chris Milligan, and then a return visit from Dean Clifford. Stay on top of it, and we'll talk to you soon. Cheers.